In today's episode, we sit down with Peter McFarland to talk about business entities for real estate agents, buy and hold investors, and fix and flippers. This is actually a recording of a webinar that we did. I'll put the link to the YouTube video in the show notes, but otherwise, you should be able to get all the information you need from this audio podcast. So enjoy.
You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
So my name is Chris Lopez. I'm a real estate agent here at YourCast Real Estate. I do a lot of work with investors. And a couple months ago, I actually started emailing Peter McFarland back, who is our co-host today, our guest host today, just with some like personal legal questions for myself. I said, hey, you know, I'm looking at possibly setting up a couple different entities, one as my for my real estate agent business, and maybe one for holding some long-term rentals with a former business partner of mine. And I wanted to start picking his brain. And then we started chatting and said, hey, Peter, actually, could we do something where we, rather than me just asking these questions, because I know there's a lot of other people around Denver with these same questions, can we do a presentation on there and share this information? Because I am not the only investor or the only agent or agent and investor out there with these types of questions. So I'm asked Peter to come on here for myself to learn, and also know there's a lot of other people out there that have questions as well. So if you guys have questions while we go through this presentation, please type them in. I will be monitoring them, and I'll be queuing them up for Peter. So my co-host today is Peter McFarland. He is an attorney here, and I know a lot of people around town have used him to set up entities. I won't mention any names, but a lot of people said they've used him. I've always heard great things about it. Peter's been great to me as I've asked him various legal questions and tax questions over the last couple of years. So he's a great guy. So Peter, thank you for joining us and welcome to the webinar.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Chris. And this is a topic near and dear to my heart because really setting up business entities and particularly for real estate investors is just something that I do day in and day out. I really love it. It's one of the one of my most favorite things that I do at the firm. So the opportunity to talk about it, and as my CPA says, hear myself talk about it is always a welcome opportunity.
We'll tie it down and force you to listen to the recording of your voice for an hour after this.
Yeah, you know, it's actually funny. I've done that before just to make sure, you know, sometimes some quality control things. And, you know, when I think, well, did I really say that? Or, you know, so one of the best things I think you can do as a public speaker is actually listen to yourself talk, as much as I hate the sound of my own voice, because you actually pick up on a lot that you may not have expected that you do. But as Chris mentioned, feel free as we're going to drop questions in the box as we go. Particularly, I like speaking in front of groups, and I like kind of doing it more like a conversation more than me just kind of going through the slides and presenting the information. And, as much as we can through the technology here, which this is the first time I've used this, crowdcast.io, but this is really slick. This is cool. And so if you guys drop the question in the box, I'll actually try to address those as I go along, because it's more fun for us at any rate. I'm not to speak for Chris, but more fun for me at any rate to do this more like a conversation than a presentation. Otherwise, I'm just talking to a wall and Chris for an hour, you know. So, but just a little bit about me. I am an attorney. I went to the University of Denver, Sturm College of Law, passed the Colorado Bar Exam, and then a genius that I was, decided to go back to school after that. My family thought that I was nuts, and I actually just studied the tax code for 1 year at the University of Denver and got my Master in Laws in Taxation. It was nothing but the tax code for an entire year, which is about as thrilling as everybody would think. And then now they changed everything on me. And so, my degree is somewhat in flux because now I have to take all of these continuing education classes and other things to stay up on all the changes with the tax law. But, as we're going today, if you guys have specific questions about tax changes, it's maybe a little bit beyond the scope of what we're doing today, but I'll try to address those as well because there's a lot happening in the field right now.
And if I can jump in here, Peter, I think we'd email about this, but we will plan on doing a webinar or some in-person classes that's totally geared towards tax as well in the future, because that is a big changes last year. So you know, if we can't get all the questions today, we'll be doing some future stuff with Peter around the tax stuff in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. Today we should really focus just on entities kind of for everybody's time. But at any rate, it is something that I have been paying close attention to. Everybody in my field should. Certainly something to talk about. But you may have seen me in the Colorado Real Estate Journal, just a few of my articles there, on our website, longlg.com there. We are on Twitter and Facebook, although I do admit it's been a while, I think, since we've updated anything on there. But if you follow me on LinkedIn, occasionally I'll put something up that I think is worthwhile, you know, some kind of change or other things. I'd love to connect with everybody on the call today on LinkedIn, so keep that in mind. Just a little bit about us as a firm. We specialize in business and tax-related matters. We provide legal counsel to companies of all sizes. We also focus on individuals. And just a few of our services, I mean, we do tax preparation, tax coaching. I'll talk a little bit more about what tax coaching is kind of at the end of the call today. Business planning, business entity creation and maintenance. We'll do estate planning for you. We'll focus in on real estate law issues. And we do tax controversy and litigation as well if the IRS does come knocking on your door. So just a little bit of what we do there. Day in and day out, I focus primarily on the business entities. I'll do some real estate law, estate planning, and the tax controversy stuff. But really, the bulk of what I do anymore is setting up business entities. And as I mentioned, I loved it. Then, you know, kind of as I don't get a huge opportunity always to step up on my soapbox. So today I'm going to give you a bit of an opening perspective on what we're doing here. And then if any of you have been on webinars or presentations with me in the past, you know that I like to give a roadmap just in case, it's a nice day outside, you know, for some reason your attention just kind of wanders, whatever. Anytime you see this roadmap come back up, that's the opportunity to figure out exactly where we are and where we're going and kind of recenter with me. Because I recognize, you know, sometimes attention spans wander and that happens. So just opening perspective here. The question is, and particularly when you're a real estate investor or really anybody engaged in business, the question is whether you're immune or whether somebody eventually will sue you. And, we've all seen these signs around town, like, what is my case worth, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people kind of, they market towards this idea of maybe trumping up the facts or trumping up kind of a situation and creating a lawsuit out of it. And we've seen a lot of these frivolous lawsuits. These are actually real life cases here where everybody knows it was Budweiser. They had an ad years ago where basically somebody sat down at the bar, they open up a Bud, and all these pretty ladies surround the person that was drinking it, and then they proceeded to have a really great time. Somebody actually went into a bar, ordered a Bud, opened it up, and no pretty ladies flocked and surrounded him, and he didn't have a good time that night. And so he said that was false advertising.
Really?
Yeah.
I've not heard that story.
That was a real case. It was filed somewhere. Budweiser's down there in St. Louis, and it actually was in a similar area. I can't remember if it was in Missouri State Court or whether it was in the district court down there, the federal court that has jurisdiction over that. But yeah, that was a real case. The other one was the clapper. We all remember the clapper. You know, clap your hands twice, the light goes on, the light goes off. An old lady actually sued the clapper because she clapped herself so hard that she actually injured her hands and the light never went on and off. And so these are really silly examples, but they are indicative of kind of the culture that we live in, right? We've always heard that the Americans, we really are, we like to litigate, right? We like to see if maybe we can get some kind of settlement for what happens in our lives. So just a real quick statistic, and I would love to find a more recent statistic than this, but $1.6 billion, and that's billion with a B, dollars were spent in 2010 just settling frivolous lawsuits like this, right? And so that just means, that regardless of whether there's any truth to these claims or not, like Bud or the Clapper, they actually had to spend time, energy, effort. Their attorneys had to go after this, and, you know, whether it actually saw court or not, which the beer one and the Clapper one did. This is time, energy, and effort and money spent just to make the case go away, right? And that's, I think, a staggering statistic, something that all of us should kind of keep in mind. This, I think, is the very scary, and this is a picture of my graduating class when I graduated law school. So, you know, the thing that we think about is that even though there's lawyers retiring, getting out of the profession for one reason or the other, there's always new waves coming in. And 80% of the world's lawyers live in the United States, right? And that's no, I guess, mistake of a statistic when we think about really how much we do like to litigate. Plaintiffs win 55% of the time. What that means is that people who just file suit for whatever reason, there's a 55% chance you're going to win, right? And so it sometimes does pay to sue. You know, there's about one new lawsuit every 2 seconds, and there's about one new lawsuit for every 12 adults here in the United States. So, you know, going back to that question, you know, are you immune or do you think somebody's going to sue you? You know, why do I bring this up? It's because if you're lucky enough to have some assets, or you're looking to build your portfolio or start a portfolio, or you're working very hard trying to build your career and your company, you know, you're walking around with a target on your back. All of us are. And it's just a symptom kind of the society that we live in. And so we just need to be proactive and we need to think about what we might do to protect ourselves, right? So another quick word is the timing of asset protection. We always have to be proactive rather than reactive when we're looking at asset protection. There are there's a concept in law called fraudulent transfers. And fraudulent to me kind of brings up this like criminal mindset where you think that, you know, you're purposefully trying to defraud somebody. It doesn't necessarily have to rise to that. Something can happen and you can be structuring and, you know, with no intent to actually defraud anybody, but they still can use this fraudulent transfer doctrine to kind of unwind the structuring that we're doing. But the idea is that you have to do things, you have to structure and you have to put in your asset protection plan into place before something happens. Otherwise, they'll use this fraudulent transfer doctrine to kind of unwind what we've done. So let me give you a quick example of what that looks like. And this is actually based on a real scenario that happened in my office. You know, somebody came in and basically had about $600,000 in equity and rental property titled in their personal name. What we didn't know at the time, or at least I didn't know at the time, was that the tenant was injured. And so we were structuring kind of after the fact and after this injury took place. And we set up a structure of LLCs to protect him. Well, unfortunately, you know, when everything kind of all the dust settled and everything, it was too late. You know, and what we had created with the LLCs really wasn't worth much because the harm had occurred before we started switching the title to the properties and getting them into the LLCs. So, you know, the perspective here is that we just have to do things proactively. We can't really plan much for what comes that we're not that we don't know about. If it's already occurred, it's too late, right? The other thing is, you know, a lot of people have come to me. I actually had an intake 2 days ago where I was talking to a very nice client, or a very nice husband and wife set of clients. And they were talking about how they were just out in Las Vegas. They had seen this group talk and, you know, they had this really great structure, but it cost, you know, however many thousands of dollars, which in my opinion was far too much, and a very complicated structure. And so a structure kind of like you see here on the right, where there's trusts, there's family limited partnerships, there's S-corps, there's LLCs, right? Depending on your situation, there may be real reasons to go after a structure as complicated as that. But for the vast majority of us, I might look to do something more like what's on the left there, right? Something a little bit simpler. And the reason is just because I want you to spend your time and energy doing what you do best rather than, you know, trying to even just figure out where in the structure are you, what role are you playing in that structure, and kind of not messing up a lot of the formality that goes along with the structure and losing all your time, energy, and effort just to running it.
And Peter, I just want to kind of clarify these images here for my own understanding and perhaps other people. So I know the one on the right is very complicated with multiple holdings, but the one on the left, it's kind of like, I'll say, a pyramid where you have a, I'm assuming like a master LLC, mm-hmm. and then you have LLCs 2, 3, and 4 below it, all independent of each other that roll up the first LLC, and that'd be like a master LLC, and then rental property 1 and 1 LLC, rental property 2 and LLC number 2, mm-hmm. and so on. Is that kind of a fair example to translate it to rental property?
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. And you're in a lot of ways a step ahead because I'll show you another slide where it becomes much more clear. But yeah, exactly. And you know, many of my clients, you know, I've helped people from just starting out with very small portfolios or a small amount of equity to clients who have a very large portfolio and a lot of equity. And the way that we approach this can scale up, scale down. It can grow. It can start out very small. It can scale up into something much bigger. You know, and so I guess it's a way kind of to just bring to your guys' attention that, number one, these structures can get very complicated. Sometimes there are reasons to do it. But on the other hand, even the structure that's there on the left with the four LLCs that I refer to kind of as simple, that's maybe even for somebody who has significant equity in three rental properties already, right? I mean, if you're just starting out, or there may be some other kind of considerations to take into account, we may actually go less complicated than that. And really, it's all going to be driven by a lot of things. Number one, what your portfolio looks like. But number two, also kind of what your risk tolerance is, and also how much time, energy, and effort do you really want to put into the structure, right? So we can always kind of titrate it to what works best for anybody.
And we have a question here, and I knew this would come up today in today's webinar, but Lynn says, isn't there an issue with the lender if a property is retitled in an LLC?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's probably like you have to defer to the lender, of course, for the details. But what Lynn is talking about is a lot of times, you know, we'll go out there and buy a property and get a 30-year conventional loan in my name and then turn around and quick claim it to an LLC. And if you actually look at the lender documents, that actually technically is not allowed. It is a due on can trigger a due on sale clause. But I'm not a lender. I'm not an attorney. I just know that's the issue. And I don't know if you can speak on that, Peter, as to what the potential ramifications are, if you want to pass that buck to a lender.
Yeah, absolutely. Lynn, it's a great question and one that comes up. Really in every discussion about LLCs that I talk about with rental property, because really everybody should weigh this and think about this. You know, the short answer is that I don't really have a great answer here. And the reason is exactly as Chris kind of honed in on. The lender's going to, in their promissory note and also in their deed of trust, have kind of this clause that says that when the property is transferred or sold from whoever owns it to the new owner, that's a reason for them to call the note due. If that were to happen, and I used to be able to say that I've never seen it happen, in the collective experience of the firm, we had only seen it maybe a handful of times, but I used to be able to say that I had never seen it happen. And then about a year ago, I finally saw the first one. I wish that I could also say, well, it was because the guy wasn't paying his bill, or, you know, there was like another reason why they called it due. But unfortunately, I can't even say that. It just came out of the blue. And he was paying his bills. So, you know, the perspective that I have there is you have to kind of weigh your risk tolerance, right? Because if we keep it in your personal name and we don't put it into the LLC, you're not going to receive any asset protection from an entity whatsoever. It's going to be in your personal name. And that means that if any harm happens, they're going to sue you personally, right? So you kind of have to look at your exposure and say, well, okay, I have exposure from the lender and that they could call my note due, or I have exposure from a potential person who's going to sue me. And, you know, which one is the bigger harm, the more evil of those two situations, right? And kind of decide how you want to proceed there. The other option is there are lenders who will lend to an LLC. You have to vet them, you know, figure out exactly who will do it. Not all banks will do it. And the reason is because of the limited liability that a company has. But, you know, the flip side of that is that even if you find a lender who's willing to lend to the LLC, they're probably going to charge you a higher interest rate right off the bat, just kind of for the privilege of lending to the LLC, right? And I guess, looking at the bigger picture, you know, you might get a really great interest rate right now, say, you know, whatever rates are at, say 4%, just to use an example. You might be able to lock in 4% over 30 years in your personal name, right, as opposed to, say, 6% with an LLC. And I'm just pulling these numbers totally, you know, out of my pocket here. It's not, you know, I by no means am a lender. I don't know that these are the rates. But say 6% with an LLC, in the short term, you might pay more, right, in interest because of that higher interest rate. But if you can lock in at 6% over 30 years and interest rates rise to 8%, right, and then the bank calls the note due, you're going to have to refinance the property in your personal name or in the LLC's name at 8% rather than 6%. And so maybe over the long term, actually working with the lender with the LLC directly was a better play, if that kind of makes sense. I threw a lot of numbers out there, but...
Yeah, and I want to... I mean, if you guys... I know another difference between these banks that do it, and they typically don't give you a 30-year fix. They'll do like a 5-year or 7-year ARM. We do a lot of work with the First Bank. Those guys do it, and I can email you guys. I list some other banks around town that will lend directly to LLCs. But I am curious, Peter, for the one time you saw it happen where you had someone actually get the loan call due, do you know what happened? Did the property get foreclosed on? Do you have to pay it all, or did he just turn around and refinance it with a local bank?
Yeah, I mean, he told me, and knowing this client, it's true, he was able to kind of jockey around equity that he had in other properties and things, and he actually was able to keep the property and, you know, was able to make things work. And so it didn't end up being a really big deal for him. But he did mention that he considered refinancing with a local lender, and that was certainly an option open to him. But just what made sense for him and his finances and his portfolio, he decided to go a different route and leverage some of the equity that he had in other properties. So.
And I mean, was it just the, hey, you got 30, you got delivery, you got 30 days? Was it, do you remember the time frame?
No, unfortunately, I don't remember that. You know, I don't know that it's necessarily a huge dire time frame kind of thing. I think the bank, for its part, would probably rather see you refinance it with them at a higher interest rate. And so, in some ways, I think the initial contacts may be to work with you, but that's probably going to vary. Wildly with lenders. Some lenders may decide, you know, very aggressively to go after this, and other lenders may be more willing to kind of work with you and be a little softer.
And I'll say one more thing before we move on. I've heard just, you know, these are total conspiracy theories that I've heard talk to lenders talk about, just kind of joking. It's like, oh, well, you know, interest rates right now are so historically low. Even though they've crept up a point this last year, they're still historically low. And they're like, hey, who knows? And this is just some kind of joking, I think half joking, half serious. But hey, give it 5 years and interest rates are maybe 6%, 7%, 8% if they go that high. Well, what they're going to do is they're just waiting because these banks are going to turn around and say, oh, okay, all of you guys with these 4% interest rates, hey, time to refinance. We're calling you. And then they refinance up to, you know, 8% or whatever. So, you know, who knows? And that is, we're getting a lot of stuff without a great answer.
Right.
So I do have one more question on this type of subject, and this may, if it's for a better slide. So I know something I've always personally debated is, you know, holding things in LLCs versus having very high liability limits on my insurance and also like a master umbrella policy that far exceeds my net worth.
Mm-hmm.
I've had, you know, not you, but different lawyers basically say, hey, look, like the lawyer's going to see what your insurance policy limits are, and generally they're going to sue the companies for what your limits are and probably not go after you for a couple more bucks.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also not a high net worth individual yet, so that's, you know, that's a different game. Is that something we can talk about now or later in the presentation, kind of like LLC protection versus high personal liability limits?
Yeah, no, it's a really great point, actually. And this is a perfect time to talk about it because I sometimes have a dedicated slide for this, but I didn't put it in the presentation today. So this is perfect. You know, for me, asset protection is a layering process. You want multiple layers. Even if we were starting from scratch today and nobody had, you know, any investment portfolio, no insurance, you know, anything already set up, my advice as soon as we set up the LLCs is always, okay, now we need to talk about insurance and get insurance in place. And I think they should always go hand in hand. So, you know, it'd be another question that I often ask, and I'll just answer it kind of off the bat here is, well, how do you get the policies underwritten so everything's covered, right? And the answer is that what I typically do is, you know, umbrella policy, general liability, landlord, if you can get it, and then put your LLCs as additional insured on there, but insure yourself as well, right? And part of the reason that I recommend that is one of the limitations of insurance and why I think it's important to still have the LLCs involved. And that's because you know, insurance is really great, and I'm not meaning to disparage it at all, and hopefully I don't offend anybody with this, but I also don't trust insurance companies all that much. Even as an attorney...
I don't think you offended anyone.
Even as an attorney, I mean, I don't pick apart my policy documents and really see where the gaps in coverage are. And everything else. And I've handled a few situations where I've seen insurance companies just walk away from situations and not pay a single cent because they say that the policy has a gap in the coverage or something, and they find some way out of paying. And so, we want contingencies on contingencies here. And LLCs, to me, are kind of the backup to insurance. And Chris, I think you brought up a really great point, which is insurance money, to me, coming from an asset protection perspective, is very easy settlement money. And it's very easy just to say, look, you know, here's what the policy is. This is easy, you know, easy settlement money. Take it. Does this make the issue go away? And sometimes it will, right? But there's another situation where, you know, there's a concept in tort law, and tort laws are personal injury. It's what happens when something happens at the property. But there's a concept in tort law that says you take your plaintiff as you find them, and it's kind of the idea that you could have this super eggshell person, and they could break their fingers, you know, just turning the knob on the door, and potentially that's who's going to sue you, right? A normal harm for a normal person, it would never happen to a normal person, but it may happen to them. And one thing I think about is, you know, okay, if you have a tenant who's, say, a retired individual, sits in his garage all day and drinks a six-pack, a potential harm to him may be less in terms of dollar figures than, say, a concert pianist who hurts their hand at your property, right? And so the question of how much insurance is enough insurance is kind of a sticky question. And so, you know, your insurance policy may pay out a certain dollar figure, but let's say your judgment, you carry a $1 million umbrella policy, but your judgment may be $3 million, right? Well, what do you do about the extra $2 million deficiency there? What I would want to do is have it kind of centered in an LLC and then declare bankruptcy with the LLC. Now, it's a really bad day because you lose that rental property, you lose that LLC. But we've kind of partitioned things off and put your eggs in different baskets rather than having somebody come back to you personally with an open hand saying, hey, your insurance only paid out $1 million. Where am I going to get this other two? Right. So it's just kind of a layering process and contingencies on contingencies.
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks, Peter.
Yeah. No, it's a really great question. I'm glad you brought it up. So we'll move off of that slide. Opening perspective is done here. Company crash course, you know, why do we want a business entity? And when I refer to a business entity, I'm really talking about any number of potential business entities here. We could have a partnership, like a limited or a general partnership. We could have a corporation, a C corporation or an S corporation. I'll go over a little bit about what these all mean. We could have an LLC. We could have a sole proprietorship, although a sole proprietorship is not technically a business entity. But, you know, why do we want to look at forming or incorporating or organizing a company? And the reason, it all revolves around limited liability. That should come as no surprise by this point. When I say limited liability, I'm really talking about this right here, which is putting up what we call an LLC or a corporate veil, right? And I want the owners to be behind this veil so that their personal residence, their retirement account, car, W-2 wages, brokerage accounts, you know, whatever else back behind the veil is protected. And then, you know, the company itself is kind of its own entity out there, and potentially any harm we try to corner off into its own LLC. And we'll talk more about what that looks like. But, you know, if I refer to, say, like the LLC veil or the corporate veil today, really all I'm talking about is just the barrier between the owners and the company, right? So, you know, another concept here is, well, one size fit all. You know, a lot of people just kind of jump to a corporation, right, or jump to an LLC and assume that that's going to work just fine. Really, it's going to depend a lot on what your ultimate goal is. You know, are you looking... And sometimes even your fringe goals, you know, are you looking to maybe protect yourself, but then also maximize your medical benefits, right? We might look at a corporation for something like that. High net worth individuals with tax change, we might actually look at creating a C corporation rather than another business entity, which for us lower net worth clients, which I count myself in there, you know, we would never look at setting up a C corporation. You know, LLCs or LPs are going to be great for asset protection. option, but there may be other reasons to look at other more flexible entities, right? Are you going to have passive or active income? Is self-employment tax a concern? You know, there's a lot that could go into actually selecting the entity. And so I'm going to go over like a couple different scenarios today, particularly geared at real estate, but recognize, you know, it could be driven a lot by personal circumstances. The other thing, too, is that I'll talk a little bit about S corporations today, but by and large today, I'm really going to be talking more about LLCs. The reason is because LLCs are almost the darling or the sweetheart of the profession because they're so flexible, but they also offer really great asset protection. And, you know, it's no surprise then that as you just kind of drive down the street and you take a look at the signs and all of the different companies and everything, you're going to see more LLCs in the name of companies than any other type of business entity, almost hands down. Just a real quick primer on what those look like. LLC for limited liability company, INC for corporations, right? LP or GP, LLP for limited partnerships or limited liability. Partnerships. So, you know, just kind of a cool thought experiment. Next time you drive down the road, just take a look at the names of companies and see how many LLCs you find compared to other business entities.
And we got a couple questions coming in. I'll hold off on these as we get through these corporation slides or these next slides. I think they'll go hand in hand with these.
Yeah, David, I'm seeing your question there, and we're really going to hammer more into that. So I'll table that for right now, but as I go, if I don't answer something specifically, as you kind of think through my answer on the slides, just let us know, and I'm more than happy to pick up any kind of concepts or anything as
and
we go along.
One question, kind of going back to our insurance versus entity thing, Wayne says, in some ways, isn't having insurance like having lawyers on retainer?
Yeah, Wayne, it's a really good point. And I guess the tricky thing with insurance lawyers, I would say, is who is the client? Because I think that the lawyers who work for the insurance company is ultimately the client of those lawyers. So to the extent that your interest aligns with the insurance company's interest, you have a great team. But were the interests ever to diverge a little bit, I think you might find that the loyalties are running maybe a different way. So that's a really good point, though. Yeah. Yeah, you can't see my face, but whenever you ask me a really good question, my eyes kind of go off to the upper right of my head, and you know, and that's exactly what I was doing there when I was thinking about Wayne's question. So, all right, so you know, another quick concept about LLCs, and David, it kind of gets to your point a little bit, is that another reason limited liability companies are the darling of what we do is because you can actually elect how they're going to be taxed. And so what I wanted to show with this slide is that basically you have a lot of different options when it comes to taxation. And these are the categories that are in the tax code. You have a disregarded entity, you have a partnership, you have an S corporation, you have a C corporation. The tax code, by and large, written in 1986, LLCs were a creature of about 1991. When LLCs showed up, the IRS didn't and Congress didn't create a new type of taxation for LLCs. What they said is, tell us what you want the LLC to be in terms of these existing categories. So with an LLC, it actually can be any of those potential ways to be taxed. It can be a disregarded entity, a partnership, S corp, or C corp. But a corporation, on the other hand, you can see it's just stuck with either being an S corporation or a C corporation. And so a lot of times what we may do is when you're just starting out, and agents in particular, I'm looking at you on this one, when you're just starting out and you know, things are just building, but you're still very much kind of in a startup phase, we might actually look at an LLC taxed as a disregarded entity just to keep headache cost and everything else down. But then when you reach a certain point, and we can talk more about what that looks like, but when you reach a certain point, it will actually make sense to switch how the LLC is taxed and go down to an S corporation. And so the flexibility to be able to do that is just unparalleled because you can't do that with a corporation.
So when you say disregarded entity, you mean basically getting taxed as like a sole proprietor?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. It's as though the LLC doesn't exist. You still have the EIN, you still have a bank account, everything is still reported to the LLC. But when you prepare your tax return, yeah, it's all just on your 1040 on Schedule C, just like how you would report everything as though you didn't even have the LLC. And if the IRS were to audit, they wouldn't even really pay attention to the entity.
But you still have to, you still have the LLC protection, and you're still paying the annual corporate filing fees on the LLC and a separate tax return?
No separate tax return, but yes to everything else.
Okay.
Yeah, really great point. The annual filing fee with the Secretary of State, by the way, is $10. Shouldn't kill anybody. But at the same time, it is something that you have to keep up with year after year. That's a really good point. But, you know, from a tax perspective, as though it doesn't exist, and so very simple to report and not a whole lot of extra cost in terms of working with your CPA or tax preparer. So, you know, real quick, just common mistakes that I see, the biggest, it's funny because what you're trying to do is create a fiction that you're going to argue in court, and it's basically just saying, look, this LLC is a separate and distinct legal entity from me. It should receive asset protection. And the way that you get there is by getting away from the argument where you just tell the judge that you paid $50 to the Secretary of State to form the company and you pretty much didn't do anything else and expect that you're going to be protected, right? That's not very realistic, and that's probably the biggest mistake that I see is what I call kind of the set it and forget it approach, right? You just pay your minimum fee and then you're done. You're probably not going to get a lot of protection out of that. What you want also is, say, your bylaws or your operating agreement. You want annual meeting minutes. You want a separate business bank account. You want to make sure that you're not commingling that bank account with your personal finances, right? All of these little formalities, and they call them corporate or LLC formalities, those all really need to be addressed and make sure that you keep up with them, because that's going to kind of create the argument and actually make it believable that the LLC is a separate and distinct legal entity from you, and it should have its own asset protection associated with it.
We got to pause here, Peter. I got questions. Other people have questions on this.
Yeah.
So Matt had asked a few minutes ago about, can you list the formalities required to keep people from piercing your corporate veil, mm-hmm. which is just what we're starting about here.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, is there like a tried and true checklist that you have clients go through? Because I've had – I'm curious about this too, because I've had my fair share of LLCs and S-Corps over the years
mm-hmm.
where I've paid someone to set up and then I've got my binder on the wall. Then every couple of years I remember to do my annual meeting with either myself or my business partner. So I am by no means a stellar client.
Mm-hmm.
And another nuanced question I've always used – I've always set up like separate business accounts – but I've always repurposed a personal credit card,
mm-hmm.
you know, say my Southwest points credit card, and dedicated it to the LLC. So it's in my name,
mm-hmm.
but you know, because getting a corporate credit card, it's just a pain in the butt doing a business credit card.
Mm-hmm.
Are things like that, I mean, can you get that nuance and say, yeah, if you use your personal credit card, even though it's earmarked for your corporation?
Well,
and that's so nuanced. So.
Yeah, no, but it's a completely fair question and one that I actually get a lot. And you know, it's not only a pain to get those business credit cards, but a lot of times really difficult because there's no history of income or you know anything else associated with the company yet because it's so new. So, totally fair, I guess. You know, what I advise my clients is, look, if you can get a credit card and make sure that it's assigned to the EIN of the company and, you know, a true company credit card, that's the best answer, right? And a lot of you may or may not work with me, but you'll know that if you ask me a lot of questions, what I'll give you is two answers. One answer is kind of the maximum asset protection answer. Then the other one's the more livable answer and probably what most of my clients are going to wind up doing. And, you know, you're not alone. The binder's going up on the bookshelf because I know the vast majority of my clients probably yeah. do the exact same thing. So, you know, I'm putting the earmuffs over my ears because I don't want to hear that. But at the same time, you know, I'm realistic. But, you know, ultimately, what I would recommend doing is exactly like you do. Earmark a personal credit card. Go ahead and have your business expenditures on there, but then create a paper trail and explain why you're doing it, right? And so have a company meeting, draft up a resolution, say, look, you know, the members discussed having a credit card available for the company because of the history of income or whatever, it's not feasible to get a business credit card. And so we're going to use this personal credit card. It started at a zero balance and everything that it's being used for and everything that's on it is business related. And so resolved, that is now going to be the business credit card, right?
Okay. That makes
and
sense.
Yeah, that way at least there's a paper trail. You can explain why you did it that way and how you're treating it. And then what's more important to me is just making sure that you're not commingling. And so that would be a form of commingling, is like using a personal account for the business. But what I'm also concerned about is more traditional commingling, which would be like I pull your business bank statements and I see, you know, all the transactions for all the stupid little purchases on Amazon that I personally make, you know, Safeway, King Soopers is on there. You know, it's like clearly personal expenditures are being paid out of the business account. That's not a good situation. So, at the very least, make sure that you're not commingling. The bank accounts and the reporting needs to be clean, and then look at your other formalities. And this is kind of getting back to the question. Look at your other formalities and, try to be good about your meetings. If you don't hold an annual meeting every year, do I think it's an automatic Achilles heel? Probably not. But, you know, I'm getting back to that idea of going back into the courtroom and saying, look, judge, I paid my $50. I should be protected, but I didn't do anything else. It's like you're going to get laughed out of the courtroom, right? On the other hand, if you're like, look, I paid my $50 to the Secretary of State. I have my operating agreement. My operating agreement says that I'm not going to commingle my bank account, and I haven't commingled my bank account. It also says that I'm going to meet annually, and here's 8 of the last 10 years of meeting minutes. I mean, that looks pretty good, right? That looks a lot better than the scenario where I say, hey, I paid $50 and I'm protected.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So a couple of those nuanced questions on here. Actually, a good tip from Brian. He says, hey, if your business banks with First Bank, ask them about credit cards because they offered him one of his LLCs. So great tip. Another good reason to talk to First Bank. Jackie said, I open a business credit card for the LLC but use my personal assets as a backing to obtain the card. Does that violate LLC rules? Peter's twisting his head trying to answer this.
It's kind of it's not the ideal scenario, which is why you asked the question, right? I mean, clearly not the ideal scenario. But on the other hand, it's what else are you going to do? You know, from a very real practical standpoint, if that's what you have to do to get the card, well, you know, okay, then that's what you're going to have to do. The good news is, and I wouldn't say that it violates LLC rules necessarily, but the good news is that I think the pledge of your personal assets should only extend just to the bank and to the extent of the credit card, right? And so let's say that you're – I don't know what business you're in, Jackie, but let's say you have a rental and the tenant slips and falls and they sue you. Is the tenant going to be able to pierce through the LLC and get to your personal assets and things because you did this extension of credit on the bank side? Probably not, right? But if you default on the credit card and the bank comes to knock on your door and looks at what they can get, yeah, you're going to have exposure to them there, right? So I think it's kind of creditor specific, so to speak, right? But that said, these formalities I was talking about not commingling and those things, that's kind of system wide. We want to make sure that at a minimum we're making sure that we, you know, don't commingle, that we hold our annual meetings, those kind of things. So
a couple other questions and then we'll move on. I know we got some more. David says, doesn't a single member LLC decision maker have personal liability for their decisions, which could potentially pierce the limited liability protection?
Yeah, David, this is a really great question. And I actually took the slides out from this presentation because I knew we'd be about 43 minutes in and not be anywhere near done. I knew that this was going to happen. So I actually took the slides out because this is, I could actually do a whole webinar just on single member LLCs and whether they receive protection and whether they don't and what the different arguments are. And to me, this is still a very open question here in Colorado. Just to kind of bring everybody up to speed, there was a bankruptcy ruling maybe, 10 years ago now in the Denver bankruptcy court, and that's a federal court. And basically what happened is that it was a single member LLC. The single member owned a bunch of real estate around Denver metro area in the single member LLC. She had to declare bankruptcy, and so the judge had to decide whether he was going to pierce through the single member LLC and force it to sell its real estate holdings to make all the creditors whole. And the judge, when he considered this question, decided to pierce through the single member LLC. That's very troubling for us, right? Particularly because at a statutory level, it seems like a limited liability company in Colorado, regardless of its type, should receive limited liability, right? But it didn't in this case. That causes a lot of practitioners to say single-member LLCs are worthless for asset protection. I don't know that I would go that far. I think that a more mature reading of that case would say, okay, in the bankruptcy context, single-member LLCs are troublesome, right? But that doesn't mean it's the same context where a tenant is suing you. Also, it was a case of what's called reverse veil piercing. And so going back to that slide that I had with the veil on it, they were it would almost be like trying to sue the business owner and then piercing through the reverse way down to the assets of the LLC. That's called reverse piercing. And in that case, we know that the single member LLC may be problematic, but that doesn't mean that traditional veil piercing where the tenant's trying to get through the company back to the owner, that doesn't mean that that's an issue. And so, you know, there's a lot of question marks that kind of came out of that bankruptcy case. And frankly, we're waiting for a lot of answers. And I said that it was 10 years ago and we still don't have these answers. So the way that I get around this, David, is I look to pair single-member LLCs with multi-member LLCs to get away from this issue entirely. But a single-member LLC just by itself, there are question marks and something that we need to look at. So really great question. That's a really deep dive too.
And we've got a lot more questions on here. I'm just going to hold the rest of them about the corporate veil things to make sure we actually get through at least a few more slides. So apologies, everyone, but this is really good content. But I know we got some more stuff to go through. So
yeah.
Carry on, please, Peter.
Absolutely. Another question that I get is where we might set up. You know, Delaware, Nevada, Wyoming, we've all heard about these havens. You know, they may have better, quote-unquote, LLC laws than here in Colorado. The question is, where are you conducting business? If you're conducting business in Colorado, you have to be registered in Colorado in order to actually avail yourself of the courts and everything else. And so all you're going to do by going to, say, Wyoming is pay two Secretary of States each year rather than just the Colorado Secretary of State. There's also a question of what law is actually going to apply. And there's an entire body of laws called the choice of law. And basically, that's just the judges figuring out what law is actually going to apply. So to give you an example, if your rental property is in Colorado, your tenant is in Colorado, you live in Colorado, but you registered your LLC up in Wyoming, the judge is going to say, why am I applying Wyoming law? Right. Everything happened here in Colorado. That's what's going to apply. So you're not even guaranteed to get the quote unquote better law. And so my recommendation is just where are you located? Where's really where you're doing business? And let's just register there. Right. For a lot of us, that's going to be Colorado. But I know people are also investing out of state, too. So we can look at what that looks like. So let's get to some real solid recommendations for rentals. Going back to this slide, I'm going to recommend a multi-member LLC taxed as a partnership. And so just to kind of give you that graphic again of the LLC and why it's so flexible and really great, I want that LLC to be taxed as a partnership. And then I'm going to partner that with a couple single-member LLCs, and we'll look at that a little bit more. Why do I recommend the partnership? The reason is because it's a flow-through entity. So there's no double tax like a C corporation or something like that. There's limited liability for your members. And so that's really good. And rents as a matter of statute don't generate self-employment tax. And so we don't need to actually do any self-employment tax planning. So the partnership really is going to be the key. That's really what we want from a tax level. And so just to give you a real quick overview of what that looks like, the star here just indicates that the tax is paid on the partner's personal tax return. And even though the partnership, the LLC taxed as a partnership, needs to file its own tax return, it never actually pays tax. There's never a moment where the LLC files a check and sends a check to the IRS. That all happens down at the partner level.
So pause there for a second. So make sure we all – so the income's generated under the LLC – taxed as a partnership, and assuming member one, number two, or 50-50 partners, you file a tax return on the LLC, but pay no tax at the LLC level, and then it flows up to, based on the percentage of ownership, to partner one, partner two, mm-hmm. and based on everything else they have going on in their personal income tax space, different tax brackets, whatever, they're going to pay respective taxes due on their share of the income through there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right, Chris. And so, you know, your tax situation is, I'm sure, wildly different than mine, right? That's true of anybody. And so what happens in the partnership kind of goes through the ringer of the tax return, and then you get what's called a K-1. And the K-1 then is input on your 1040 on Schedule E, and that's getting a little technical. But the whole idea is that basically anything that happens in the partnership comes out to me in my percentage. And so I could be a 50% owner or 5% owner. I could get 5 or 50% of the benefit or the burden of the LLC. And then whatever's happening on my personal tax return, that's actually going to impact the amount of tax that I pay. And so depending on your situation, Chris, and my situation, if we were partners in an LLC taxed as a partnership, we could actually pay wildly different amounts of tax just kind of based on what else is happening in our lives and what else is going on the tax returns.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, this very concretely is the recommendation. And this gets to your point earlier, Chris, about where are the properties and how does all that work. And so, yeah, I recommend kind of a parent company, right? I refer to them kind of as like parent and subsidiary or master and subsidiary. But, you know, I want the parent company to be a multi-member LLC taxed as a partnership. Husband and wife works just fine, right? And for a lot of my clients, that's exactly what we do. But we do want two owners to get away from that bankruptcy ruling and kind of the problem with the single member LLC, right? But then we have single member LLCs below that, 100% owned by the master LLC. And the reason that we do that is because we can put the different properties in different LLCs, get your eggs in different baskets. But then because there's only one multi-member LLC, there's only one tax return for the whole structure. So here we're looking at three different companies, but actually we're only looking at one tax return for the whole thing.
And a technical question here from Wen. He says, that means we still need to file LLC tax form 1065 by March 15th deadline rather than the April 15th deadline for the personal 1060, right?
Yeah, Wen. And I'm glad to see Wen on the call. I'm glad you showed up. But yeah, that's exactly right. The master LLC will still need to file that partnership tax return. And then just for everybody's benefit, the deadline, you're exactly right, Wen, is 315. And the reason is because you get those K-1s off of there and you need that information to prepare your personal tax return, the IRS pushed the deadline a month before. So you actually have enough time to get that form and actually get your return in. And theoretically, you don't need to go on extension. But, you know, whether that actually works out in practice is another issue.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know the listeners out there. I doubt I can be the only one that's forgotten about S-Corp and LLC deadlines and then had that oh shit moment come like April 1st. Back to your slides, Peter.
Yeah. So hopefully that makes sense for rentals. I won't dive much more into that just for time's sake here. But recommendations for self-employment. And here I'm talking about rehabilitations, fix and flips, right? Also agents. You know, here I'm going to look at an S corporation. And you can see kind of by my slide here, we could do an LLC taxed as an S corporation, or we actually could even do a corporation taxed as an S corporation, right? It just kind of depends on where you are in the history of your business, and are you kind of in your startup phase? Are you not? Do you need the flexibility of the LLC? Would you prefer kind of the more set case law and everything that goes along with the corporation? There's reasons why we might choose between them, but from a tax perspective, an S corporation is what I would heavily consider. And I'll go through kind of why. Just a real quick look at the advantages, disadvantages. Once again, an S corporation is a flow-through entity, which means we get away from that double tax problem. But the advantage of the S corporation and the reason why I'm even talking about it is because it limits your exposure to self-employment tax. And if you're doing several rehabs a year, or you're an agent and making a fair bit of money, the self-employment tax is a real concern. It's about an extra 15% tax on your income that you otherwise wouldn't need to pay if you just structure correctly.
And for clarity, self-employment tax is what we see as FICA on our pay stubs that goes towards Medicare and Social Security, right?
That's exactly right. And the reason that it's a problem is, like, I'm an employee of the law firm, right? And Stephanie, she's my employer. And so when I pay into the system, I pay about 7.5% or whatever. Yeah, about 7.5% myself towards all of that unemployment, FICA, FUTA, you know, everything else. And then Stephanie matches my 7.5% as the employer, right? Well, the problem is that when you are self self-employed, there's no Stephanie for you, right? You have to pay the extra 7.5% as your employer. And so that's kind of where this really becomes the sticking point and where the issue arises. So the S corporation is the way to plan around that. That's why we're talking about this. The disadvantage, though, is that, you know, there's more of a headache, time, hassle, energy associated with it. And I'll talk a little bit more about what that looks like. But real quick, just a similar slide. I actually created this slide right off of the partnership slide. It looks almost identical, right? Because it is that flow through company where income flows through the S corporation. It does need to file its own tax return. But once again, everything happens back at the shareholder level, right?
Can I ask you a couple questions about S corps?
Yeah.
And if you get next slides about these, let me know. But so can you still get that limit, the self-employment tax, through an S corp and through an LLC tax as an S corp?
Yep. Yeah, okay. And I think I was trying to make that point, but I'm glad you asked it, Chris, because it really centers in exactly on this issue, which is that an LLC taxed as an S corporation is identical to a corporation taxed as an S corporation for tax purposes. So, you know, I deal with a lot of IRS auditors. They come into my office quite a bit. I have one coming in all day tomorrow. It's going to be a total blast. But at the same time, you know, that aside, you know, from the auditor's perspective, it doesn't matter that it's an LLC or a corporation because it's an S corporation. When he's auditing, he's looking for S corporation issues because from an IRS standpoint, from a tax standpoint, they're identical, right? But from a state law standpoint, they're a little bit different because the LLC single member, right, the single member LLC has the problem associated with bankruptcy, whereas the corporation might not. Right. So from an asset protection perspective, from a state law perspective, they're different. But from a tax perspective, they're identical. Right.
Okay.
So it's just a little bit different. And that goes into the decision making and kind of like, well, do we want an LLC or do we want a corporation? Right. We kind of have to run through the ringer on that and decide. And the tax is always out there. They run in parallel. But, you know, there's kind of two separate trains of thought that you have to go through. So here. You know, this gets into why the S corporation is really important. The reason is because when you receive income from your S corporation, you're going to pay yourself two ways. You're going to pay yourself a reasonable salary and you're going to pay yourself a shareholder distribution. And just so you know, I do an entire webinar on just what a reasonable salary looks like. So if you're going to ask me what a reasonable salary looks like, I can't give you a real straight answer because there's a lot that goes into that analysis.
Isn't
enough
a lawyer's
to fill.
Favorite word, reasonable?
I love no, that. They say it's reasonable. I say it jokingly because then it's just like, what the hell is a reasonable? Whatever.
Well, that's the thing is that actually I hate the word reasonable because it can mean so many different things. But yeah, this reasonable salary is kind of the important bit. And so on the reasonable salary, that's what the self-employment tax is going to be paid on, whereas the shareholder distribution, there's no self-employment tax due on that. So just to use a really quick example, and this is just a lot of math, and I'm not necessarily going to dig too far into this, but you know, if you run through a single member LLC and it's that disregarded entity, which is, as Chris said, kind of like the sole proprietorship, it's as though it doesn't exist for tax purposes. If you run $100,000 through that company, you're going to wind up paying a lot more self-employment tax because you pay the self-employment tax on the full $100,000. Looking at the right side there, running the same $100,000 through, I just went with a 50-50 split and say $50,000 is a reasonable salary. And don't go with the 50-50 split, by the way. Just doing that percentage is on its face not reasonable. But at any rate, you know, just doing that, you can see that actually the S corporation is going to save about $7,650 just running through that. Now, this math, it's actually kind of an older slide. There's the new 199A deduction that came in with all of the tax changes, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And this is not taking into account the additional 20% that potentially you might be able to deduct on the S corporation. But the truth about that is that I can't even integrate that into the slide because there are so many factors that go into your personal situation that's going to drive what that deduction looks like. So just suffice to say, and you can see just by, you know, so to speak, checking the box and becoming the S corporation, you're going to save quite a bit of money. And that's just through structuring.
And I don't know if you know this because I know of that 20% I don't know what you call it, but that 20% break they're giving pass-through entities now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, does that apply to rehabbers and does that apply to real estate agents?
Yeah, this is a really good question, Chris. And in a way, I should almost put together an entire talk just on this new 199A deduction. But that,
I would agree with that.
That would be... That would be a bear to take on. But Chris, if you want me to do it, I'll do it. But, you know, the ultimate thing with it is you have to look at – there's like three different tracks with the 199A deduction. And the first kind of threshold thing to look at is how much money you're making. If you're over a certain dollar figure – and I can't even say what that dollar figure is off the top of my head here today because I'm just – I'm in business entity land right now. I'm not in 199A land. But if you make over – it's somewhere around $300,000, $315,000, then you're pretty much phased out of the 199A deduction period, right? If you're below that mark, then there's three different tracks, and we have to look at what track you might be in. One is called specified trade or business, and basically that it's just a list of professionals that Congress said, you know what, these individuals are not going to benefit from the 199A deduction as much as other individuals might. And lawyers are on there, doctors are on there, architects, engineers. Actually, architects and engineers I think were specifically exempted, but actuaries are on there. Rehabilitations, flippers, you should qualify. Long story short, agents, on the other hand, that's a little tricky, and I'm actually waiting for some clarification to come from the IRS on this point, because there's a catch-all in that specified trade or service category that basically says that the biggest asset of the company is the reputation and skill of the employee. There's a way to claw a lot of people back in under that definition, right? And so if you're a really heavy referral-based industry, right, and it's really your reputation is driving a lot of this business, you might actually get clawed back under the definition. Back into where you're not going to benefit as much from the 199A deduction, but you may still see some benefit. It's just very convoluted and tricky, and I can't really give you like a yes or no answer.
I'm going to have to forward you over these emails I get from the National Association of Realtors touting how they made it work for realtors.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I don't think I've also gotten those, but I'm really curious now. Anyway, so random question here. David says, hey, Peter, are you able to provide a copy of the slide deck after the call?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Let me see.
Well, we'll put those into like a PDF and I can get them out to everyone.
Yeah. And before we go here, I'll go up. There's my email address right there. Right. And so feel free to reach out to Chris. Feel free to reach out to me. Just say, hey, you know, I'd like some a copy of the slides. More than happy to pass those along. Certainly would love to.
Okay.
You can see there wasn't a whole lot of presentation left. I managed to catch up a little bit.
I am impressed. So, do we miss anything, like any juicy details on the S-corps there in the last two slides you went through?
Yeah. The biggest part is because we're looking at integrating wages into the picture, right, you're going to have to work with payroll. And payroll potentially, you know, I have referrals and things and people that I think do a really great job. But payroll is an extra headache. It's an extra hoop to jump through. There's quarterly reports. There's payroll processing. There's time, energy, resources.
And fees.
Exactly. That go into that. And so that's why, you know, if you're just starting out or, you know, you do the one-off deal or something like that, it may actually not make sense to be an S corporation because the savings that you're going to generate aren't going to outweigh the cost and the time and the energy and the headache of the S corp, right? So that kind of gets back to that point of, well, do we want an LLC or a corporation to be taxed as an S corporation? The flexibility of the LLC, that's what makes the most sense for people who are just starting out, right? Because we can be that disregarded entity right off the bat, not have to worry about the payroll, the salary, whatever. But when it does make sense, we can flip the switch and become that S corporation and then generate the savings. Also, if you're only doing like the one-off flip or the, you know, the rehabs aren't just, you know, you're not doing a whole lot, You have to go through an analysis too, where maybe it actually makes sense to report those as long-term capital gain versus inventory, right? When you're doing maybe say three or more flips in a year, it actually begins to look more like inventory. You look like what they consider a dealer in real estate. And at that point, when the sales are actually of your inventory, you're not going to get the long-term capital gain treatment. But on the other hand, if you hold on to the property for more than a year, which would be a really long rehab, you know, it might actually make sense to treat that as long-term capital gain. Right?
So did I hear you correctly? You're saying if you do, like, and I'll just say three or less flips, which is a general rule of thumb, I understand. But even if I were to flip one property a year part-time and it takes me, you know, 6 months to rehab it, I could still classify as long-term capital gains even though it was less than a year holding?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to hold it longer than a year. That's the minimum threshold to get the long-term capital gains, right? But aside from that, I think you have to look at the larger history and say, well, how many flips are you doing a year, right? If you're just starting out and you only do one flip and it takes you longer than a year to do, treat it as long-term capital gain. That's going to be the best treatment you can get, right? But on the other hand, if you're up and running, this is your fourth year, you've got 15 flips under your belt, that's looking more like inventory, right? Because you're not kind of that like one-off, and it's not so much like a capital, what they call a capital asset, kind of held longer than a year for investment purposes, right? It's more like your inventory in your business.
And do you remember, this kind of goes back to the whole, like, you know, when you want to get taxed as an S-corp. And this was, I mean, almost probably 12 years ago when I did an S-corp. And based on whoever I was talking to at the time and calculations, I came up with this number. This might not be my correct number, but right around, like, once I was making $50,000 in profit per year, so wages, profit, all that stuff, that was where it seemed to make sense to go from a sole proprietor to an S corp.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a, or do you know, like, is there like a rule of thumb for, hey, if you're making, you know, X amount of profits, so wages and profits for that year, when it might start looking, make sense to switch over to an S corp?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a moving mark for a lot of people, actually. I'm actually below that $50,000 mark, but then again, I might be a little more aggressive, right? I've talked to a lot of CPAs who won't even look at making the S election if there's less than $100,000. And so I think it's going to depend on your desire, I guess, to jump in and run a company and kind of, you know, be on top of the payroll and reporting and, you know, everything else. Because if that's really not what you want to do and you really want flexibility and you want ease of running the company, that mark is going to be a lot higher because you just don't want the headache, right? But on the other hand, if you want to save as much as you possibly can in tax and you're willing to kind of go through a little bit more to get there, it might be a lot lower, right? So I think it's a moving mark for a lot of people. But aside from that, the frequency that you pay yourself, I think, is also going to play into that as well. Because if you're only paying payroll once a year to cut a salary check at the end of the year, that's maybe less expensive than, you know, paying yourself monthly or quarterly, or, you know, so there's a lot of different ways you can approach it, but I guess it's going to be kind of different for everybody.
Great. Well, I know we're over the hour mark, Peter, but do we have time to run through a few questions
here? Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So I know we got some questions that piled up here, so we're going to start going through those. If you guys have some final ones, type them in here. We'll do our best to get to them. But here is us going fast. Scott Kimball said, is taking your LLC from a disregarded entity to an S corp based on the level of income the LLC is generating so you can get the best tax breaks? That's what we just talked about. Yes, right?
Sorry, I was let's see. Is taking your LLC from it to an S corp based on the level of income the LLC is generating so you can get? Yeah, Scott, I think that does really go directly to what we were talking about there. There comes a point, it's a tipping point, where it does make sense to make the S election and kind of go through the time, energy, hassle, and everything of doing it. And I think you're right. The level of income really is going to be what drives that. So I don't know, Scott, if there's more specific questions there, more than happy to go through it. But yeah.
And sir, I'll read those questions a little slower. I will. I'm going fast
fine.
And no one can understand
no,
me.
No, Chris, I was actually looking at the question above that, like, really briefly. So that's totally on me. Yeah.
So this is a question from earlier we got on the tangent about piercing the corporate veil. Matt says,
can you please provide a list of all the required formalities? And is there a list of all the required formalities? And based on your facial expression, I'm...
I don't have like a dedicated checklist that just says, yes, all of these things must be completed, right? I mean, Matt, you could go through and read some of the case law associated with piercing through the LLC veil and get a really good sense for what it is that they're looking for. But the biggest ones are really everything that I've already answered. You know, you want to make sure that you don't commingle your bank account. You want to make sure that you have your annual meeting. You know, don't ever let your LLC go delinquent with the Secretary of State. Make sure you always file that annual periodic report and pay the $10, right? Aside from that, there are other formalities that you could do which may be value added. In the operating agreement that I draft, for instance, other formalities really pointedly would be making sure that your formation is actually complete. And when I say that, don't just file with the Secretary of State and then assume that you're done, right? You do want to get a separate EIN. You want a bank account, and then you're not going to commingle that bank account. Draft an operating agreement. Make sure that you do have one. Draft initial company minutes, kind of saying, okay, who's authorized to sign checks? Where's my bank going to be? You know, those kind of things. Finish out the formation, and then once you've kind of laid the groundwork through the operating agreement in your initial meeting of how the company's really going to run, then run it that way, right? And if you say that you're going to meet annually, try your best to meet annually, right? And then I was going to say a value-added one that you could do is like operating agreements that I draft, I say that anybody holding more than 10% of the ownership interest of the company can call a special meeting. And that would just be something over and above the annual meeting. But, you know, a great example is like I had to switch banks for my LLC structure at one point. And, you know, once I kind of finished getting through just the headache and hassle of switching banks and moving my accounts over and whatever, then I went back and actually called a meeting. And said, okay, look, you know, the prior bank that I was using was charging me a ridiculous amount of fees and, you know, whatever. I found a better bank and so resolved this new bank is going to be the new bank of the company, and further resolved, Peter's going to be the one who can sign checks on behalf of the company, right? It seems very formulaic and kind of silly to do. But on the other hand, I'm getting back to that idea going into the courtroom and saying, look, you know, look, I have my 10 years of meeting minutes. Oh, and by the way, peppered in there are other things that happened along the way that were just kind of so bizarre or outside kind of the day-to-day management of the company that I thought it was important that I actually capture them in the record of the company, right?
Great. A couple other questions here from previous ones. Last year, I paid off a rental property. Do you recommend equity stripping paid off properties with a mortgage to another entity that you own?
Mm-hmm.
Do you recommend equity stripping paid off properties with a mortgage? So that means pulling out equity from that one property, then buying another property, moving it over?
Well, yeah. I mean, Matt, I think this is a really great question. It's a good concept, this equity stripping, because if you paid off a property, that's going to be a very juicy potential, you know, thing to go after, right? If you ever were sued. And so equity stripping is not a bad move, but I would be concerned about maybe making it a mortgage to another entity that you own, because, you know, I think judges are people, right? They have to stick to case law. They have to stick to what, to some extent, what the prior cases are telling them and what the statutes are telling them. On the other hand, they're people too. And if you don't have, say, a jury trial, if it's just going to be a bench trial and the judge is kind of determining the facts and then making the decision, which is probably the most landlord-friendly way to go about it, the judge is also going to be taking into account what happened to the tenant and then try to figure out, well, where does the equity lie, right? Because judges are always trying to find the equity and do what they think is right in the scenario. And so that isn't always going to be landlord friendly. So if a judge sees a loan that strips out equity from the property that potentially the tenant would be able to reach and sees that that loan is with another entity that you own, there's really not a lot of substance to that loan, is there, right? And so they may look to unwind that a little bit and see if there's a way that they can poke a hole in there. So my suggestion would be, you know, leverage the property and maybe get another rental property, but have an actual lender, right? That would be kind of a more traditional way of approaching equity stripping and maybe a more effective one.
So like you're using the equity from the paid off property as a down payment on another property, you know, say 25% down, and then get another, you know, a traditional loan as a mortgage for the second property.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yep.
So a couple other questions here. Ivan asked a while ago, said, I am a CPA. If my LLC provides bookkeeping, tax, and consulting services to my wife's LLC, is that commingling?
Yeah, that's a good question, Ivan. And I think a lot of people get a little turned around on commingling. No, I don't view that as commingling. The reason is because there's no bank account issues there, right? As long as your wife's LLC has its own bank account, the income is deposited in that bank account and the expenses are paid out of that bank account, and then you, for your business, have its own bank account and the same thing happens over there, you're not commingling at all there, right? So I guess the business relationship is not so much the concern as just following the dollars and where are they deposited and where are they paid.
And that's assuming that wife's LLC is paying fair market rates for husband's LLC. What if it's – I'm assuming that because, I mean, is it if he's giving services for free, mm-hmm. how does that change the ball game?
Yeah. Hey, Chris, you're a step ahead and I love it. I mean, I guess from an asset protection perspective, I may not be overly concerned with it because, again, it's almost specific to who's suing you, right? And so just because there's kind of this sweetheart deal between two companies wouldn't necessarily derail it if a third party were trying to sue into that, right? But on the other hand, from a tax perspective, you may have issues. And if the IRS ever were to audit or something like that, then, yeah, there could be potential income concerns and expense concerns, deduction concerns, and maybe even gift concerns, although there's an unlimited marital deduction. So the spouse thing kind of throws another wrinkle in that. But yeah, certainly would want to make sure that there's a fair fee paid for the services.
Great. Well, I think we've got most of the questions answered. If I missed it, I apologize. You can email us. We'll try to do it later. But everyone, thank you for coming out. Peter, thank you, of course. And right before we hit live on today's webinar, Peter and I were talking about doing a couple other webinars in the new year just around, you know, he already mentioned a couple different possible presentations and tax stuff. So hopefully we can get some of those things organized because I want to learn as well. And I know I get clients all the time asking me for advice and stuff, and I would love to have a library resource to say, hey, look, go watch these three webinars, and you'll get great advice, mm-hmm. and that's a great starting point. And I know a lot of other people out there, you guys are in the same boat. So be on the lookout for those emails that we can hopefully get to. All right, everyone. Again, thank you so much. And Peter, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it, too.